We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
It's the Dort Podcast. It's the Dort Podcast. Rich Keith. It's the Dort Podcast. Hashtag. It's the hashtag Dort Podcast.
It's a bonus episode of Hashtag Dork this week. My name is Rich Keefe, and we are joined this time not by Ryan Davey, but by our resident Hashtag Dork attorney, also my sister-in-law, Nicole. Nicole, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you today?
I'm very excited to talk about this show, The Staircase.
I know.
Now,
I'm excited.
When did you first hear about it? Because you knew about it way before I ever did.
Yeah, so I heard about it, I can't remember, I would say 2010 or 2011, maybe a little bit later. And so it was only the first part. It was only the first, I think, 8 episodes. And it was all online, and I watched it way back then.
Yeah, because it wasn't, so Netflix advertised it, and it was a little confusing, because it was like, oh, bonus episodes. I'm like, well, I've never even heard of this. I'm like, is this the second season? Like, what are we doing here? But you had said that they came out earlier, and as you're watching it, you can kind of understand, because it starts all the way back in 2001. So they had something, they thought the story was pretty much done, and it wasn't. So this is spoiler-free, so for those that haven't seen it yet, we're just going to sort of let you know what it's about. Essentially, you have a man in North Carolina who's a writer, and he finds his wife dead at the bottom of the stairs, hence the staircase, and then it turns into a, was it an accident or did he murder her, right? That's pretty much the story?
Yep, that's it.
Did you like it?
I did. I liked it when I saw it, and I had seen it before I saw Making a Murder and The Jinx.
Mm-hmm.
I actually think I recommended it, or it was one of my pick of the pots.
Oh,
but,
shit. All right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Well done. You're way ahead of the game right there.
I didn't have time to go back and listen to make sure I'd actually done that.
I'll take your word for it. It counts.
Okay. So I had seen it before those two shows, and I think it's not as well produced, I think, as Making a Murder or The Jinx, but I think it's well done for what it is, and so I did enjoy it.
I feel like they have more access in this one, in the sense that it's not one-sided, and they're spending time with the prosecution, they're spending time with the defense, they're spending time with the defendant, they're spending time with his whole family. Like, they're telling you the whole story, whereas Making a Murder, I think, did that a little bit, and you're right, it might have been a little bit better produced. It looked more like Hollywood quality, but
right.
I think it was really of the side that, like, they were trying to make him look innocent, whereas this is like, you're not really sure what's going on with this. Also, you get a very different perspective than, so Making a Murderer, let's be honest, Stephen Avery, maybe not the smartest guy going, right? Probably
right,
fair?
Right,
this
right.
Guy,
that's
Michael,
exactly right.
Michael Peterson, much different. You know, he's a writer, he's very well educated, but in a similar situation where there's like a lot of evidence against him, there's evidence, you know, where it looks like he's innocent. But I thought he's a compelling character, very different than both William Avery and Stephen Avery and Robert Durst.
It very much so. And I think that the other difference is this: you get from the very beginning, from when right after, you know, his wife is found dead, up until the end of the trial. And so I think it's really unique in that it's like an up close and personal look at what it's like to be on trial, what goes into defending yourself in a trial situation. And I don't think the other documentaries do that. And so I think this is a really sort of unique piece of film because of that.
I think they're all worth watching. And this one might be, I don't know, because I got sucked into Making a Murder real quick. And we did an episode a long time ago. Long time Dork fans remember that. We did that when that came out. That was really good. We didn't do one on The Jinx, but I did enjoy that. This is pretty in-depth, though, and it's 13 episodes. They're all between 45 and 55 minutes, so there's a lot, but it didn't take me very long to get through it, and I can't imagine it did for you either.
No, not at all.
What would you give if you're gonna give it a score? We did the Dork score 1 through 6, or I guess 0 through 6. Knowing what it is, obviously it's hard to compare to, you know, Thor Ragnarok. But how would you compare it to, say, the other you know, true crime documentaries?
Okay, so can I? I'm gonna break this up into two.
Yeah, please.
The initial 1 through 8 or whatever.
Six.
The
one
numbers.
One through. I thought you meant the scale.
No, yeah. I would give those probably a 6.
Okay.
And I'd probably give the last ones a 4.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then, so would you give it a 5 altogether then?
Probably.
Yeah, I think I would probably give it a 5. And again, I watched it all together, but there really is, not only is there a time jump, but there is just a different feeling with the later episodes.
Yeah,
so that's what I felt. So I don't know, is there anything else non-spoiler we can say about this?
Probably not, I don't think.
Yeah, just because I hate spoilers, and I think almost anything is a spoiler, so I think that's pretty much the story. If you like those other kind of true crime documentaries, or if you like the podcast Serial or things like that, you're going to be fascinated by this. There's a lot of discussion to have, but don't really want to tip you off too much. So that's the crux of it. It's a more well-to-do guy, and this time, did he kill his wife or did he not? That's really all you need
right to
know. All right, here we go. Let's spoil
okay
away.
Spoilers! 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 Here come the spoilers!
That's our spoiler alarm. We have to play that. So the first question, and before you answer the question essentially is, did Michael Peterson kill his wife, Kathleen Peterson? That's the whole premise of the entire 13 episodes. So let's start with reasons why it was him or could be him, and we can just kind of go back and forth. And again, we're not jurors, we're watchers, so this isn't just what was brought in court. This is everything, whether it's something shady you thought he said in an interview or if it's just hard evidence that they had on trial. What would be things that would point you in the direction of why it was him?
Well, so I said this to you previously when we were talking about this. He's odd.
He is an odd duck.
He's kind of narcissistic.
Yes.
There's something off about him. His reactions, his emotions don't seem appropriate at certain times. And he just doesn't leave you, I don't think, with a good feeling.
And what was really
one of them.
Yeah, what was crazy to me, and I agree with that, was that early on, like the first episode, they're sort of setting up what it is. And then the first thing you get is like an interview with him in his house. And I'm like, wait a minute, is that the guy that they think killed his wife, and we're just like
right
straight up talking to him in his house, and like that's
right
not his fault, but just the way he was going about it, and he was walking you through it, and I'm like, God, I mean, I've never even imagined to put myself in that situation. I don't know what kind of things I would say or what I would do, but I think there are a few that I wouldn't say. Like, for so one thing that jumped out to me was they're all going through like the nights of the or the you know, the events that happened that night, and his two adopted daughters, Martha and Margaret, they got home, and I believe they said the first thing their dad said to him was, "It wasn't me."
Right.
Which I would not say that. I'd be like, "Your mom fell down the stairs." Like, if that's what happened,
and
I'd be like, "Your mom had an accident." I would never even think that they thought it was me.
Exactly. And then the one son, the older son, Todd, when he showed, he was there before the police. There are so many things
that's
about
really
that
sketchy
night.
And that makes Todd, and I don't want to implicate anybody, but just Todd's also odd. And I mean, a large part is because that's his dad, but he was there very early, and I'm like, that's an eyebrow raise for me.
Right. And I had, so I went, full disclosure, I told you I watched the Forensic Files after this. I wanted to see what else.
Very nice.
Todd was originally almost a suspect.
I'm telling you, I thought he, like, afterwards, and again, we're kind of jumping around, but it's either accident,
right,
it's either Michael Peterson did it, we have another theory that we can introduce that's making the rounds around the internet right now, and then you're like, all right, well, if it was an intruder, which is something that the defense brought up momentarily, and then they kind of dismissed it, but if it was an intruder, just, or even an intruder, or just another person, I don't know, I think Todd kind of stinks. Like, I don't know if I feel great that it wasn't him.
Exactly, or he was at least there after, like, he knows more
yes
than he was letting on, and he refused to be interviewed by the police the entire time, so he was never interviewed.
Ooh.
Which is so highly suspect.
That is suspect. I also thought all the blood, like, I know they went through it, and forensics was a huge part of it, and the blood splatter, and you have some people on the stand that are just, you know, making stuff up, others are more compelling. Like, there's a lot going on there, and I guess they can sort of tie it up, but what do you just think of somebody falling down the stairs And this is very graphic. Like, this is, they show you, you literally see Kathleen's body with the police cam. They show you that footage, which is pretty, like, that's in the first or second episode. You're like, oh my God, yeah, like, this is intense.
It is an up and close look at a crime and the trial afterwards. There was a lot of blood. I don't understand. I mean, I've never fallen down the stairs like that, and
it was everywhere.
Very tragic, obviously, but I don't understand all of the different wounds on her head. It makes absolutely no sense to me. I don't understand how she hit her head that many times that hard from a fall.
Yeah, and like the pattern, and that's a big part of the trial is obviously in, you know, looking at the marks. So she didn't have skull fractures, so they kept going on. The defense team was like, well, see, she wasn't like blood. She couldn't have been bludgeoned to death in like a you know, fit of passion or whatever. And you're like, yeah, I don't know. Maybe she still could have been. Like, so you're convinced she fell down the stairs with those? Like, they don't look like.
Right.
Yes, I don't know. That didn't seem to help anybody.
No, it did not.
Well, the whole blow poke thing drove me nuts.
I don't understand that. I don't understand why they saw it was missing and then became convinced. This, I'm talking about the prosecution.
Yeah.
They searched the house. They saw that a blow poke had been in one picture and it wasn't there. And they just automatically assumed that that was the weapon.
Like, I've seen a lot of TV and movies, and I've, you know, followed a handful of, you know, national court cases. I've never seen them say, this isn't the murder weapon, but it something like this. Like, what? Like, you,
right.
Like,
and we're going to wet ourselves to this, right? Like, it's got to be something exactly like this.
And they're, like, holding it in front of the jury. They're like, you see this right here? Well, this isn't it. But something that is like a brother of this is what did it. And you're like, yeah, maybe, but where is it? And then they find it later on, and the whole thing was just very strange.
It was very strange. It was very, very strange.
All right, what else makes it look like it was him?
The affairs. So for me, it wasn't so much that he was bisexual.
Yeah.
It was that he was actively seeking out to have affairs outside of his marriage. And if she had found out about that, that could have been something that led to a drunken fight, because they were both intoxicated. They weren't like a lot intoxicated. It was like
she was
0.07.
Yeah.
What was he? Do you know?
I don't know if they ever tested him.
And then she had some Valium in her system, and it was 2 o'clock, 1 o'clock in the morning. And one of the episodes, I can't remember if it was The Staircase or The Forensic Files. She had gone up. She had sent an email at midnight. I think they cover this in The Staircase. And so his timeline is off. And she was using his computer because she had left hers at work. And so she could have found something on his computer, come down, confronted him, and they'd gotten into an altercation, which I think it makes a lot more sense than, like, falling down the stairs.
Yeah, I don't see the falling down the stairs. But then I'm surprised the defense team never even, you're like, all right, if you think that the wounds are from stairs, like, why didn't he push her down the stairs? Like, couldn't that also have been? Like, and that never really got brought up, or at least not nearly enough. But I'm with you. The timeline's strange. They take him at his word that they're at the pool, and they run that ridiculous scenario where they have the taped lady screaming for help. I'm like, this is so dumb. And I'm like, first of all, it's his word that he was outside. And they're like, see, he couldn't have hurt her. Like, well, he might not have been outside.
Right. And the other thing, too, is it was like 2 o'clock in the morning. Granted, they were in North Carolina, but it was December. And the average temperature, I think, is like 55 degrees.
Oh, that's a good point, too. That's weird. I also,
And he had a shorts and a T-shirt on. What are you doing outside at 2 o'clock in the morning?
Yeah, I don't know. And then, like, EMTs got there, and they said all the blood was really dry. And so we hear the 911 calls, and he has a couple of them, and he's freaking out. But you wonder how quickly he did that if they get there and the blood is dry. Another thing that was odd that jumped out to me is because obviously when the police get there, they look at the scene, and they have video evidence and everything. And when he's doing that interview, when we first see him, and he's walking around his house, and he goes into the family room. And this is an odd thing, and maybe this isn't for everybody, but I picked up on this. He said that they were eating dinner there. And then they just left. They left the plates in the family room, and then they got up and went outside. If you have a dog, which I do, and he does, you don't leave your food. You can't leave your plates like in the family room, or the dog's just gonna lick them clean.
Right.
So I'm like, I think what happened was there could have been an argument and the plates were still there. Then perhaps he murdered her, and then and he obviously isn't going to go clean up the plates. So then when the police come, he has to put that as part of his story that the plates were still there.
Right. It doesn't make a lot of what he says doesn't make a lot of sense.
And also,
why wouldn't you just pick them up? Even if you didn't have a dog.
Yeah, right.
It's 2:00 in the morning. Yeah. He doesn't work. You're just going to leave the plates?
Yeah, I don't know. And then, so going back to the bisexual part, which was a big kind of breakthrough for the defense, that came out in, I don't know if it's the second episode or not, but that was sort of, because like each episode early on kind of gave you something else, like what was going on. And so the bisexual part of it was, he was very ambiguous as far as how much Kathleen knew. And
right.
then in the later episodes, he pretty much comes clean and is like, she didn't know.
No, she didn't.
Didn't know at all. And he was like, well, she was aware of it. Like, well, what do you mean aware of it? Like, there's an understanding. Like, there wasn't. Like, there definitely wasn't. That's something that he lied about. And we already know he's a liar because
right.
this is a guy who was in Vietnam and then he got injured and he was like, oh, it was a war injury. Like, no, it wasn't.
Right.
So
and he claimed
bad.
He had a Purple Heart. Ugh. And didn't he run for mayor and lie about having a Purple Heart?
Yes. Yeah, he ran for mayor and he lied about, I think, the injury and then maybe also a Purple Heart. So that's the worst part is lying about what happened in the war to him. Like, that's horrible.
Right.
Like, yeah, you're right. Him being bisexual, who cares? But the fact that his wife didn't know about it, that's clearly a motive for a big argument and then something else to happen.
And they clearly had an image that they wanted to present to people.
Yeah, and that's
the other thing that I find a little fishy.
Yeah.
No couple that you're friends with are perfect.
No, trust me.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, you couldn't. Everybody had this sort of like Tony. Oh, they were perfect. They were the loves of each other's lives. They laughed all the time. Their family blended so perfectly. Everybody called her mom, even though they already had one. Like, there were so many things that I was like, it can't be that perfect. With that many kids, all around the same age, all living in the same house, it can't be that perfect.
And when I think it was Margaret or Martha was talking about it early on, the youngest one, and she was saying how beautiful their relationship is, I was like, that's weird. Like,
weird.
Who would describe their parents? Well, I don't know. Maybe some people would. I wouldn't, but some people would. Maybe that's just more about me than about them. I don't know. The other thing that was pretty crazy, Nicole, was so it was like the first episode, you get interested in what's going on. Then they're like, oh, he's bisexual. You're like, oh, there's another element to it. And then how about when he was living in Germany and his friend and the mother of Margaret and Martha was also found dead at the bottom of a staircase?
Yes.
That's insane.
That's insane. And even backing up a step further, the way his relationship with that woman was strange.
Which woman? Oh, the woman that died. Yeah, Ratcliffe.
Ratliff, right?
Yes.
It was like her husband died, and he just stepped in and became a surrogate father and husband to this family, even though his wife and children were living next door.
Yeah, pretty.
Right?
Yeah, like, that's what it seemed like, yeah.
The night she died, he was at her house tucking in her children.
Yeah, it was very
strange. And his wife and their two children went home. I mean, I just don't think that, I mean, that just seemed so odd to me. And then the other thing, this is a really small point, but when he was walking around the kitchen and pulling out glasses and showing Martha and Margaret the stuff that belonged to their mother.
Yeah.
And how she used to collect these pieces, and he was with her when she was collecting these pieces.
Oh, they had quite a relationship.
I just couldn't figure out.
See, I don't think he killed her, though. Do you?
The first one?
Yeah, I don't. I think what happened was he saw that she was dead, and she, because remember, she had all kinds of like brain, she had like a brain aneurysm, or she had like brain issues, right? Or was it brain or heart?
Right.
She had something. And I think she died there, and I think he saw, okay, they saw, they came, like, oh, stairs, like stairs, like stairs could kill him. And I think he used that for Kathleen.
Oh, that's interesting.
I think he was like sort of not motivated necessarily, but or inspired, whatever word you want to just, whatever you want to put on it. I think he saw that and was like, oh, like they didn't ask any questions. There was no criminal case or anything. And like they took, hey, people fall down the stairs. So that's what I think happened.
I just wonder if they had an affair.
Those two? Oh, it might not even have been an affair. It might have been. Everybody might have known about it.
Oh.
Because the other wife there, the ex-wife who popped up a few times, I don't even think she likes him at all. Maybe never did.
She is the strangest of them all.
She is bizarre. She's one of those people that you meet that it seems like they're living on a different planet in the sense that
a completely different planet.
Just like they couldn't relate to anything. Like she's probably never ever seen like a sports game. She's never seen like a movie that's not like a really serious documentary or like an old French film. Like she's just speaks with these huge words. Like you're like you're not from here.
And she speaks in the third person.
Yeah, she's
about,
strange.
Like. You know, when she's speaking to their sons, well, you probably feel this. And you're like, what are you? It was crazy.
Yeah.
When they got divorced, they all moved to America with him, and she stayed in Germany. The whole thing was odd. So maybe you're right. Maybe it wasn't, maybe the affair he was having with that woman, maybe it was, maybe it wasn't, maybe it was known. I just wonder if, I mean, she was wealthy. Margaret and Martha's mother was very wealthy.
Yeah.
And he got a lot of money. I also thought it was odd that she left the kids to him.
Yeah. Well, initially it was to both of them. Like,
right.
Right. And then they got a divorce, and then the kids ended up going with him and then Kathleen.
Right.
So it was actually really helpful, that one scene with the defense attorney. Which one was it? Not the main guy. Ron. Ron, the guy with like the mustache and like the longer hair.
Yep.
Him and one of the other people did like a whole, almost like a family tree one episode. That was really helpful. Like they're like pinning the names, like they lived here and then they moved over here and then they moved over here. And then you see how all of a sudden the family is enormous, but they're all, you know, you got one biological kid here, two adopted kids here, two like, you know, half brother, whatever it is. So it was like, that made sense. That was helpful. Two other quick things for me, that reasons why you may have done it. Well, you could probably talk yourself into either way with the 911 calls, but they were kind of,
they were over the top. I felt like he was acting the whole time.
Yeah, and he did two different ones, and they were different.
Right. And he gave this interview right after he was coming out of court one day, like right in the very beginning, where he makes this statement where he says, I've said Kathleen's name a million times on my heart.
Yeah. That was
you're just like,
what?
What?
Yeah.
You just got accused of killing your wife.
He also had a weird thing at the end where he was talking about, and I think he was referring to being bisexual or gay or whatever at the end, and he said something about, you know, when you can get away with something for so long and like nobody knows about it. But all I was thinking about was like, you're talking about murdering somebody.
Right.
Like that's what seems like you're borderline confessing. But I don't know. I honestly did go back and forth. Like, early on, I thought he definitely did it. Then there was, like, a middle part where I'm like, you know what? Maybe he didn't. And then by the end, I kind of... So, all right, before we answer that, though.
Okay.
Do you have any reasons why it wasn't him or couldn't have been him? Because it... When I was making this list, I was like, I'm not really sure how I feel. And then I had so many more for why it was than why it wasn't. But why it wasn't, I don't know. The stairway was really narrow. Like, it was a crap stairway, right?
Right. And the stairway was narrow. She had Valium in her system. She had been drinking.
Right, yeah, that's it.
I think that they never identified a murder weapon, and I think the injuries were strange, and that she had all these blows to her head, but no hairline fractures.
Yeah, very,
no,
very
like,
strange.
No, very strange. And so, and the blood spatter, there was no cast off up high.
Mm-hmm.
And...
I don't know. They were so focused on like these death blows with an instrument. I'm like, well, why couldn't he have like choked her or like hit her and then threw her down the stairs or something? Like, I don't. They didn't go to that. They were like, well, if there's no weapon and it didn't fracture her skull, then it couldn't have been a person. And you're like, well, I don't know. I think it could have been.
It could have been, right? And so, yeah. The blood spatter was strange. I just think that we never really. They were never able to really answer why.
Yeah, I think her finding out that he was having gay affairs would be the most likely reason, and then her maybe threatening to leave him or threatening to tell people or threatening, who knows? Like, I don't want to say what she was up to, but something like that, and then he snapped. And he does seem like a guy. It was also a little bit of a breakthrough. Not that I think it's the end of the world that parents like spank their kids. Like that happened all the time, trust me. But for it was kind of revealing when they were like, you know, did they asked his sons, they're like, did he ever hit you? And they're like, yeah. And you're like, oh, okay. Like, because they painted him out to be like this really nonviolent guy at first. And then you're like, well, he was in the war. Like, he hit his kids. And you're like, okay. Like, maybe there's a little bit of a violent streak to him.
And he's a narcissist.
Everything
was about him. I mean, even through this entire filming, you could see he kind of got off on, like, the fact that he felt like being the center of attention. I mean, the way he...
Him smoking his pipe, I was you're a TV character now. You're a movie character. This is ridiculous.
Yeah. And he felt like he was, right? And then with the two girls, the two adopted daughters, they're sort of in, like, infatuation with him. Mm-hmm. Was weird. I think just that his personality required that. And these were two girls that had been traumatized by the death of their parents, and he takes them in with this, like, savior-like complex that it appears they kept the whole time.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Seriously. And then I guess the other reason would be like in this case anyway, it's not like he got like a lot of money. Like there was not like, you know, it's not like she had all the money or like, you know, other cases where we've seen, you know, a husband or a wife killing. Wait, she did?
So this is what they kind of left out was that they were having some financial problems because her company's stock had gone down and Michael had not worked for 2.5 years. And she was the sole breadwinner.
Oh, never mind.
And she had a $1.5 million life insurance policy in her name.
Okay. So was it, they mentioned that or did I just miss that?
I'm having trouble because of where I saw it, but I'm pretty sure they did the prosecution mentioned the life insurance policy, whether or not they mentioned that he hadn't worked for 2 years. And the other thing that I saw on the internet, can I say that now? Is it?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Have at
it. Is that Michael Peterson ended up dating one of the producers on The Staircase.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
What? Boy or girl?
Girl.
Oh, interesting.
Yep.
Well, now let me introduce this for the other reasons why he didn't do it. This is what's been making the rounds recently. And it came out a while ago, but now after everybody has seen the documentary, something that is left out entirely from the documentary is the owl theory.
Mm-hmm.
The owl theory, and allow me to read some from Wikipedia.org. In late 2009, there was a new theory into Kathleen Peterson's death that was raised that she had been attacked by an owl outside, fallen after rushing inside, and had been knocked unconscious after hitting her head on the first tread of the stairs. The owl theory was raised by Durham attorney T. Lawrence Pollard, a neighbor of the Petersons who was not involved in the case but had been following the public details. He approached the police suggesting an owl might have been responsible for the reading that the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation evidence list and finding a feather listed. Peterson's attorneys had determined that the SBI crime lab report listed a microscopic owl feather and a wooden sliver from a tree limb entangled in a clump of hair that had been pulled out by the roots found clutched in Kathleen's left hand. A reexamination of the hair in September 2008 had found two microscopic owl feathers. That's pretty insane, but I'm kind of in on the owl theory.
You think she was attacked by an owl?
I think there's a good chance. Although
I don't think so.
Pollard did not speak of the theory to anyone else. The Durham Herald Sun newspaper published an article ridiculing him and discrediting his theory. Other media picked it up, which later criticized as inaccurate. Advocates of this theory assert that other evidence supports it, namely, the scalp wounds were tri-lobed and paired, consistent with marks left by talons. The feathers are similar to those on owl feet. Cedar needles were found on her head and body, indicating Kathleen had fallen over outside shortly after before entering the house, that her blood had spattered up the staircase rather than down, that her footprints and her own blood indicated that she was already bleeding before she reached the foot of the stairs, and that two drops of her blood were found outside of the house on the front walkway, along with a finger smear on the front door, consistent with her pushing the door shut. Advocates also note that owl attacks on people are common in that area, with one victim stating that the impact was similar to being hit in the head with a baseball bat. You're still not buying it?
No.
According to Pollard, had a jury been presented with this evidence, it would have materially affected their deliberation and therefore would have materially affected their ultimate verdict. Prosecutors have ridiculed the claim, and Dr. Deborah Radish, who we see in the film, who conducted Kathleen Peterson's autopsy, says it's unlikely that an owl or any other bird could have made wounds as deep as those on her scalp. However, Dr. Radish's opinion was challenged by other experts in three separate affidavits filed in 2010. Dr. Alan Van Norman wrote, quote, "The multiple wounds present suggest to me that an owl and Miss Peterson somehow became entangled. Perhaps the owl got tangled in her hair, or perhaps she grabbed the owl's foot." Dr. Patrick T. Redig, a professor of veterinary medicine at the University of Minnesota, wrote, quote, "In my professional opinion, the hypothesized attack to the face and back of the head resulting in the various punctures and lacerations visible in the autopsy photographs is entirely within the behavioral repertoire of large owls."
Yeah, but
nothing.
Like, if she had been outside, okay, say she, and screamed, right? Why did Michael Peterson hear her?
I guess.
I mean, an owl comes at your head, you're not silent.
You've kind of poked holes in the owl theory. If it was an owl, why didn't Michael Peterson say it was an owl?
I mean, and like she would have been screaming. Or, I mean, anybody who gets dive bombed by a bird yells out. I mean, maybe not everybody. We probably can't prove that scientifically, but
maybe Michael wasn't home. Maybe he was having a gay love affair, and he came home, and she was dead. And then he had to present the story because at that time he was trying to hide the fact that he was out having an affair.
Maybe. Maybe.
I can't believe you're writing off the owl theory.
Yeah, I just don't think she was attacked by an owl. I do think it's strange that she had a clump of her own hair in her hand.
Yeah.
I don't understand that.
And an owl feather.
She also had thyroid cartilage damage, which is consistent with strangulation.
Yeah, they didn't really go with that either. It was all about, like, bludgeoning on the head. And I was like, well, what about strangulation and what about push down the stairs? But they kind of left that out. And again, I'm surprised. Maybe they think the owl theory is so stupid. But the owl theory was presented, we gave you the dates there, sort of in between filming. Because they filmed, you know, 01, 02, 03, whatever it was, 04 for the early episodes. Then they came back. And so it was while they weren't filming. But they didn't even bring it up. But what are you going to do?
Right.
All right, so
yeah.
we're both kind of leaning towards Michael Peterson.
Yeah. I mean, I walking through everything and all the strange, when you add up the affairs, the fact that he was actively trying to have an affair, like, around the time.
And you read, you found those emails to Brad.
Oh, my God, yeah.
It was very graphic, very intense, and very confident.
Very confident in his abilities.
Yeah.
And very confident with sharing that confidence.
Oh, sure. Yeah. A lot of detail in there.
Lots. So if his wife found them.
Yeah.
She'd be mad. I don't think so.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Right? I just can't imagine that she would not. She had a couple glasses of wine. You're hanging out. You're stressed out from work. You go upstairs to do an email. And suddenly you find these emails from your husband to a male escort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he had clearly done that before.
Well, then what's crazy is there was that other guy that he had slept with, and the defense got a hold of him, and they were like, yeah, he said you guys hooked up or whatever. And Michael's like, he did? He, like, his voice gets so high. Like, as the series was going on, I felt like his voice got higher and higher. But then it was really more just like when he was presented with something, his voice would get like 10 octaves higher. He was like, what? You gotta
be shitting
me. And you're
exactly.
Like,
exactly.
But you did. Like,
right.
The guy told the truth. And so are you lying about this now? Like, he does. He bends the truth a lot or just straight up lies a good amount.
Right. So, I think as a narcissist, he can justify anything to himself.
But I was still pretty surprised by the verdict just because based off of everything we saw in court. So, like, the court, they don't have the advantage of seeing the weird interviews that he does. And, like, really, they didn't hear from him at all, in fact. Like, he didn't take the stand. So you don't hear him and get the sense. Like, the first thing we said is he's odd. They don't know that.
Right.
They have no idea. They just hear what people are saying up there. I'm sure, especially in North Carolina, they hear about the bisexual stuff, and they're a little, like, they're probably more turned off about it than others would be.
Particularly in 2001.
Yeah, that's also true. By the way, some of the jokes that the defense attorneys were making.
Oh, terrible.
I'm like, you can't do that. Certainly in 2018, like, they were, like, right in front of Michael Peterson, too, and, like, Michael Peterson's brother, and they're, like, laughing about it. Remember, like,
yeah.
Rudolph was, like, pretty crass in a bunch of scenes because he was like, oh, like, what would they need to do? Like, whose dick would they need to suck? And then they're like, oh, what are you, a swallower? I'm like, what are you doing? Like, this isn't
right.
Right?
So and back to the trial, I also think to that point, if he were tried again today,
mm-hmm.
I don't know that a judge would always allow in the evidence of the murder in Germany or the... some of the homosexual evidence.
Yeah, in fact, I think Judge Orlando Brown or Orlando Hudson was there for the entire thing, which is pretty funny to see as he aged, as with the, you know, some of the other DAs were swapped out, but the judge remained the same. And Orlando Hudson even said at the end, yeah, like, they probably shouldn't have included the Germany stuff or most of, if not all of, the bisexual stuff. And if that was the case, he definitely would have been found not guilty.
Right.
Because that stuff was just too hard, like, too much of a coincidence, the double stairway deaths. And
yep.
Then, again, we've said what we've said about the bisexual stuff. But even with all of that, I didn't know. They definitely didn't prove him innocent. But, again, that's not the job. They just have to prove that he's not guilty. And I kind of thought they did.
I agree. And I think, you know, this kind of goes back to what we were, the conversation we had around making a murderer is, what does it mean to be found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right.
And I definitely think, even though I think he did it, I can't say beyond a reasonable doubt that he did it.
Yeah, I definitely couldn't have. Again, without watching the documentary, we have so much other footage that we get to see that we get to make our own opinions. But if I was on that jury, and the access, like, they were in the courtroom the entire time. Like, you saw
right.
everything. And so that was, I was surprised by it. Now, the closing arguments by... Harden. So Jim Harden was the DA. He talked
yep.
so slow and so soft, like, the entire time. He said, if a picture is worth 1,000 words, he said that like 3 times. And he's like, and mm-hmm. if these walls could talk, I'm like, are you just getting cliches? Like, what
yeah.
are you doing? What? And then he had
a
PowerPoint. I'm like, this guy is brutal.
So I think one of the things they tell you is you want to have a theme.
Yeah. Oh, he'd have a theme. All right.
And you want to hammer it in.
Yeah. He
hammered over and over and over again, because that's what you want the jury to remember.
But it was like he was talking to 5-year-olds. I was like,
yeah.
Okay, we're dealing with a murder case here, Jim. Feel free to mix in a little something different. No, and he didn't have the PowerPoint. David Rudolph had the PowerPoint, which I was surprised was even, like, allowed.
Oh, no, you can do demonstratives.
Interesting.
And you can create your own demonstratives, and you can and your own exhibits.
I feel like that'd be helpful for everybody involved, because you can see it. And then it's easier, both for the attorney, but also for the jury. I feel like it's
yes.
not a bad idea.
Because you're trying to, I mean, you've got 12 people who don't want to be there.
Correct.
Who don't understand the law. I mean, to be honest, they don't have sort of the same nuanced understanding that you do. And a lot of the deliberations and a lot of the evidence presented is very technical. And so you need to present it in a way that they
yeah.
understand it and that they remember it. And for me, as an attorney, what the most stressful part of the entire series was the night before the trial, when he's trying to work out the technology in his presentation with the guy who's operating the
oh my god
the slideshow.
So stressful for you, the most enjoyable for me. I was laughing out loud. He was getting so mad at that guy. That was the best scene of the whole thing, I thought.
And you can just feel it, right? He knows he's got to go to court tomorrow. You're always nervous before you go into court, and it's always a stressful situation. And you have it in your mind how you want it to present it, and this guy is just not on the same page.
His phone kept ringing. His phone kept ringing, and he's just like multiple times. And then he's like, yeah, I screwed up. And he's like, yep. And then he's getting so mad at him. And then he has like the wrong slide. He's like, yeah, there's just one out of order. And then he has that little bar in the thing. He's like, can you get rid of that bar? He's like, well, yeah, not right now. I can't, but I can get rid of it. And he's just
right.
Like, I was like, this guy's incompetent.
Incompetent. And then, you know, you've got to go into court and expect and hope that he does a decent job. And that kind of those kind of screw ups.
Yeah.
Impact the jury. They stop listening. They only focus on.
Oh, definitely.
The fact that
oh, I would be
right.
I'd be staring at those bars. I'd be like, "What are you doing? Like, oh, this oh, one's God, out of frame. Like that.
It like kind of gives me anxiety to think about.
Oh, I bet. Now, so speaking of the jury, it took them 5 days, and then they all ultimately reached the guilty verdict. I've never seen this before, and again, just from court TV and movies, but. They said, like, how do you find him? They said, we found him guilty. And then the judge went through every single one of them to make sure they didn't change their mind. Is that normal?
Yeah, you can ask to have the jury polled.
Okay, because they did that. There's like juror number one. I'm like, oh my God, yep. We're going to do all 12 of these guys?
Yep.
All right. So that was interesting. Now, the Alford plea, is that only in North Carolina?
No.
That's everywhere?
Yeah.
I've never heard of that because I've heard of people... saying, like, you know, admitting guilt just so they know they can get a lesser sentence, but I didn't know about the Alford plea.
Yeah, there's a couple different pleas I think you can take. I mean, I'm not a criminal attorney, so I'm not as well versed on that. But yeah, because an Alford plea is you're not admitting guilt, but you're saying that there's enough evidence to convict you, so you're going to plead to avoid a trial.
Hmm. Okay, so Michael Peterson ultimately gets 8 years in prison. Then he gets out, and he's basically on house arrest for 2.5 years, and right now he's free. Now, I know he was in prison, and I know he was an older guy to begin with, but he aged like a president. Like, he was so old by the end. Like, he couldn't walk upstairs comfortably. Like, he was a mess.
He was a mess.
What else we got? So anything else on any of the characters? So we have Michael Peterson. We've said a lot about him, obviously. Kathleen Peterson. Oh, a little trivia. They were watching American Sweethearts, was the last movie they were watching. That's what he said in episode one.
Interesting.
Todd Peterson was definitely odd. Clayton Peterson seemed a little bit more normal. He was the one with the wife and the kids.
Right.
Martha and Margaret, we already hit on them about how they were completely on board with their dad. They thought he was innocent the entire time.
Right.
Caitlin, we haven't mentioned her at all. Caitlin Atwater, who is Kathleen's biological daughter. She was on record very early on saying her dad was innocent, and then she switched, and then she was on the other side and sat on the DA's side the rest of the way.
Right. That was kind of sad. I mean,
it was.
That, you know, she split from the people that, you know, were her family. But I think, right, she decided to switched her position when she saw the autopsy photos and found out about Michael's affairs.
Yeah, I think she had no idea about the bisexual stuff, so I think that kind of shook her. So then she said the person I knew couldn't have killed her, but I don't know him. And like I think that was pretty powerful. And then her aunts, Kathleen's sisters,
they were kind of a lot.
My goodness. Now, I'm just surprised. And again, they know him better than certainly we do, and even based off of the documentary that we saw, but they were like right away adamant that it was him, like 100% it was him. And I was like, that is, especially Candace. I mean, Candace was aggressive when she was coming after everybody. She was, but it was like, it was probably much too much. But she was sure that it was him.
Right. So I thought it was a lot. I thought it was a lot at the end, at the final episodes where she got up and gave a statement and was just like screaming at Rudolph. And I mean, Rudolph was hired to do a job and he did his job, right?
Correct.
But then I thought about it, if it had been my sister.
Yeah. You might've done the same thing.
Yes.
Or are you implying that if I did that to your sister, is that what you're saying? Or your other sister?
I would hunt you down. I would probably kill you myself. Like
I would hire David Rudolph, and I would go to prison for 8 years. Then there'd be an owl theory, and then I would get out.
Exactly. And if you got out, I would probably get arrested for like stalking you and making your life a living hell.
Most likely,
Right? Yeah. So when I thought about it in those terms, I can see her behavior makes more sense to me.
Yeah, it does. But I was just surprised, like, and early on in the process, too, was like there was no doubt in her mind that it was him. And you're like, well,
right.
They obviously didn't have a very good relationship. Like, she would have, I assume with you, if God forbid something ever happened, you'd be like, yeah, it was probably an accident. Like, that would be the first thought. And then, and then you find out that I have all these emails trying to hook up with these escorts and the Marines. And you'd be like, all right, wait a minute. Hold on, hold the phone.
Exactly.
So,
and you know, and then you start to add up the pieces, and yeah.
Yeah, like there's no owls out there. It couldn't have been you. Bill Peterson is Michael's brother, and I guess, so he's also an attorney because I was he was sitting in on a lot of the different stuff. He seems
so
more,
he was way more normal,
way
right?
more normal, like a whole different person than Michael. Yeah.
But so now he was so present for the first, I mean, right up through the trial, through the verdict, the guilty verdict. And then for the later episodes, you see the other brother, but he didn't come back.
I don't, yeah, we didn't see him or Todd in the later episodes.
No, I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, yeah, because you wonder what their relationship was like for those 8 years, how often they talked, and what happened. Who knows?
Exactly. Because didn't you get the impression that which one was the younger one, Martha or Margaret?
I don't remember. I mean, I know I could see the face of the younger one, but I forget if it's Martha or Margaret.
She didn't seem to. I mean, she seemed to, until he was let out. She seemed to, in the later episodes, in the very beginning of the later episodes, kind of question his guilt, I thought.
Yeah, I mean.
8 years is a long time. You don't know what happened. I mean, how often do you think they visited him?
I don't know. That's a good question. We have no idea. And it is, especially with the two young daughters, they were sitting right behind him throughout the trial. And so you could just, like, see their faces, like, not just at the end result, like, obviously they were crying, but you got people on the stand talking about, like, he's trying to hook up with these dudes. And she's just like, their eyes are just like, oh, my God, like, this is really happening right now.
They're
like, that's tough. Now, David Rudolph, the attorney, pretty much the entire way through, there was a little off and on by the end, but he was helping him out, hooked him up with other people. Now, sports fans would be interested in this. David Rudolph also represented Ray Carruth, who played for the Carolina Panthers. He also went to Colorado before that. He's known for conspiring to murder his pregnant girlfriend back in the day. And I was looking this up. Ray Carruth's still in prison. But I think he's eligible to get out in October, which is insane. He should probably not be out of prison. But David Rudolph had him.
Interesting.
How crazy, too, was... Yeah, so he's... I don't know if he's like a celebrity lawyer, but with these, those are two very high-profile cases. But, you know, Peterson and Ray Carruth. And then it was crazy how... So he didn't want to do it. And then he's like, I got this other guy, though, that he'll help you out. And then right before... the more recent trial, that guy... What do you have, like a stroke or something?
He couldn't represent him anymore.
And then that woman had to step in, and she did obviously a good job for him. Let's see. Ron was in Tom Mahar. Those were the two of the other guys. Oh, one thing that I thought was odd. Odd's not the right word. Those guys, after a day at trial, during like an 03 or whatever, they'd go back and watch Nancy Grace talk about the trial. I'd be like, why would you want to hear that?
Yeah. Like, I wondered that too, and I think part of it was they were talking about how publicly they played sort of to the public and the media in this case, and so I think they were very tuned in or in tune with how they were being covered.
Yeah, and there was
the
there was false information too, like because we were there, we got to see all what was going on in court. And then they'd come out and they would make up stuff every once in a while. It'd be like a detail that's completely wrong that they would that they would say in there.
But I think that watching how sort of outsiders like Nancy Grace or people on her show were perceiving the trial would give them maybe a slight indication of how the jury was also interpreting things.
Oh, that's a good. Yeah, okay. All right. That makes sense then to me. Yeah, I gotcha. What did you think?
What played well? What didn't play? You know, what played poorly?
What they need to go back and clear up, or what they need to emphasize. That makes sense. What did you think of Josh Carton? He was the witness coach who had the "I shit a sheet" guy. That guy was ridiculous. He had like the beard and like the hair, but like what a job! Like that, he's a witness coach. That's how he makes a living. It's incredible.
Right. You know who I'm looking at, who you've left off the character list?
Who? We're not done. We still have a couple more.
Yeah, no, but it's not on here. Brad.
Oh, yeah, your guy, Brad. Well, it's because you just read all his emails.
Yeah, well, that's right. But he was my favorite when he testified.
Oh, yeah.
What did he say?
Well, he was like, because they asked him. So Freda Black, by the way, the assistant district attorney, She was hilarious. She also seemed like from a different time. Like, this was 01. Yes. That was not that long ago. Like, I was in high school in 01. It's not, like, forever ago. And she has, like, the makeup. She looked like a Waiting for Guffman character.
She did. And she acted like one, right?
I think the way
she characterized some of the homosexual stuff was distasteful.
Oh, my God. Like, her face, the way she was like, these are men. He wants to have relations with men. And she was like, her face was just like, couldn't believe that what was going on in these emails. But anyway, yeah, Brad was very good. He wanted to, like, sugarcoat it because Freda Black was like, so what would you do with Michael Peterson? And he's like, do you want me to say what, like, I would do with Michael Peterson?
Wait, when he said, didn't he say, like, I don't know Bo Diddley?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He had a really good line about that. Like, yeah, he was like, it was ridiculous. But it just summed up that whole exchange between Freda Black and Brad.
That was one of my favorite parts.
Now, the worst guy, I mean, we're almost done the podcast. We're almost at an hour. But the Dwayne Deaver was
just getting to him.
The worst guy. And, like, I even made a note because I knew we were going to do an episode after, like, three or four. I'm like, well, this is good enough. This should be an episode. So I started taking a few notes. And all I wrote about, well, I go, the blood spatter analysis, is the bald forensic guy was brutal. Like, that's all I wrote.
He was brutal.
I'm like, he's awful. Like, the way he talks, the way he looked like, almost like Milhouse's dad, but, like, thinner. You know, like, he was just obnoxious. And he's literally he is the reason why maybe both I don't even know if he's the reason why he went to jail. I know that's what the defense was saying, but he's definitely the reason why he's out of jail.
Right. I do think he's the reason why he went to jail, because when the jurors were asked sort of what solidified their decision, a lot of them said Dwayne Deaver's testimony.
They did. But if they took out the Germany and the bisexual stuff, do you think Dwayne Deaver's alone would have gotten him in?
Well,
maybe.
I don't think you can take out the homosexual stuff altogether. Like, I don't think you could, because I do think that was, if that was their motive.
Yeah, that's true.
That would have to come in. I think it probably wouldn't, it probably would have been narrowed. The scope of what was allowed in would have been narrowed. It wouldn't have been every single piece of porn he ever looked at on the internet.
Right, right, right.
So that would have still come in. I don't know if the state's forensic analysis person is testifying and telling you that there's no way he could get blood spatter on the inside of his shorts, and that like certain things on the wall with the splatter analysis are true in a way that is not scientifically accurate, probably.
Yeah. No, that's okay. Yeah, so I mean he was a huge part of it. Now my other question would be, as watching it, because there was also the other case, and I guess I didn't write the guy's name down, the other guy that was put away and then got out, and Dwayne Deaver was on that case as well.
Yes.
What is the point? If you're a blood splatter analysis, why do you need to find a way to convict him? Like, shouldn't you just say what the evidence is? Like, why do you care?
You shouldn't care.
So, like, is he getting paid by somebody? Like, would that be the only logical thing I could think of? Like, why else would he want to make sure, like, oh, this guy's definitely guilty? Like, no, just say what happened. That's your job. Like, I didn't get that part.
I mean, don't you think he just fancied himself to be more knowledgeable about criminal stuff and got a little power hungry with what he could do in a lab and kind of got too big for his britches and
probably
thought, well,
yeah,
I know all this stuff, and he lied, right? I mean, he said he had been,
like, what's his motivation now? I don't get it. Yeah,
and he had not been.
Now that was hilarious when they were going through. It's like, you said you did like 300s, like, you've done four, or like, you said,
right,
like, you've done all this stuff. And then they had all the real experts come up and they're like, this is what Dwayne Deaver did, is that normal? And they're like, no. And so, well, he's the worst.
And Dr. Henry Lee was considered, because he was involved in the OJ trial, one of the preeminent blood spatter analysis scientists in the country. I found it so interesting when they polled him, when they did the jury testing with him, because people couldn't understand him.
Oh,
they
yeah.
Didn't believe him.
Yeah, that's messed up. But that's, I mean, I think, not to say that that speaks of the entire South, but I feel like that's more likely to happen in the South.
Yeah.
And they were just like, yeah, we have no idea what he's saying, but he had like the correct information, but
right. He'd written the book.
Yeah. Dwayne Deaver has not. I wonder what Dwayne Deaver is up to right now. We need like a where
probably
are they now?
Not a whole lot, right? I mean, so he was on the Forensic Files, and he was really. I mean, they had videoed him. Oh, it was so ridiculous.
Oh, funny.
They had videotaped him going through the crime scene pictures with his gloves and his lab coat on. Like just to give you sort of an idea
Dwayne.
Of his personality, exactly.
Yeah, very helpful, Dwayne. Now, Judge
right.
Orlando Hudson, when he was very first on screen. I was like, oh, boy. Like, I thought he came across as, like, dumber than he ended up being. But, like, the very
right.
first thing he said, and again, maybe it's just he speaks a little bit slower, similar, like, with Jim Harden. But then as it got going, I was like, okay, I now see how this guy could become a judge. Before, I was like, oh, we're in for a long trial here.
Right, right. You know, I think he did a fair job.
He was
I think
fine.
He erred
yeah.
on the side of caution and letting the things in. And
yeah.
I mean, I was just surprised he ordered the exhumation of that one woman's body.
Oh, that was messed up.
Or allowed for that, yeah.
That was really messed up. Now, the replacement for Jim Harden, there was a couple of replacements. They've gone through a few DAs down there in Durham. The first one where Candace just is screaming at the judge that she's not fit to run this trial.
That was very interesting.
That was interesting, but she was also right. That lady, not great.
Yeah, no, she wasn't great.
I was like, how on earth did she become a district attorney?
Votes.
And then we went back to it a couple of years later, and she was no longer the district attorney.
Right.
So they swapped
them
out.
She didn't come across as the sharpest tool in the shed.
No, not at all. What else are we missing? Anything else here?
I mean, I maybe go back to Dwayne Deaver. I mean, he was the worst.
He was the absolute worst, and you knew it at the time. And it's not like, I don't know if I was really rooting one way or the other. I was very curious on what way it was going to go, and that he was just so sure of himself. And I thought Rudolph did a pretty good job of talking to him then. He obviously
right.
didn't know he was a complete liar then. Like, how would you know? Like, that guy's supposed to be the expert, so you're kind of taking him at his word in a way. But just like we said with Michael Peterson, he's odd. Like, with Dwayne Deaver, you just knew something was up with him right away.
Right. Well, and just to go back with Dwayne Deaver, when they were talking about how all the stuff they were finding out in the later episodes about how when the evidence came in at the lab, there was supposed to be DNA testing, but I guess they had foregone a bunch of testing because Dwayne Deaver wanted it sent to him in blood splatter.
Right.
Like,
I'll take it home. They're like, no, what?
What? Exactly. Right. And so why wouldn't there be all these testing? And now I think what would happen is that you would request the evidence, and if you could afford it, which they clearly could, would do your own DNA testing.
Yeah, that makes
right?
sense.
Right. I mean,
yeah.
it's a lot more available now if you have the money to conduct that. To
yeah,
have your
I
own.
I mean, this is also even by the time the first trial got going, that was 15 years ago.
Right.
So things have obviously changed a bit, but I mean, just a crazy, crazy story. And like the story, like initially, if it's just man finds his wife dead at the bottom of the stairs. He says he didn't do it. Maybe he did do it. Like, that alone is pretty intriguing. But then when you added all the elements of, you know, the hidden affairs and the dead woman at the bottom of the stairs in Germany, like,
right.
all that stuff, that's what really made it even more compelling. And I think, again, we started the podcast by saying, like, all of them, like, when you're comparing it to Making a Murder, The Jinx, and this one, they're all pretty good. But this one might be the best one.
Right. I think I would agree with that. I think it gives you the best glimpse. I also think an interesting thing is to compare this to legal representation that Michael Peterson was able to pay for
yes.
compared to the representation
yep.
that Steve Avery had in Making a Murder, and sort of the unfairness, I think, between what you can get if you can pay for it and the defense that you basically can't put on if you can't pay for it.
And yeah, there's a scene between Michael and his brother where they're talking about just that. He's like, yeah, he's like, the rich get off just because they can afford to do it. It's not like they're like, it's not because they are like, oh, that's a rich person, I don't want them in. It's like, no, because they get to pay for the best defense attorneys.
Right. I mean, all of that stuff. Dr. Lee, yeah. the jury consultant, the witness coach.
Yeah, what they spent, they spent like close to, I don't think it was $1 million, but it was up there. It was like $750 maybe.
Yeah.
They spent a ton of money.
And I wouldn't be, I mean, today it would be well over $1 million.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you
oh,
have
right.
to, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and that's how you, I mean, and he put on a solid defense. I do think they demonstrated that there was a reasonable doubt, particularly at that trial, of whether or not Michael Peterson had killed her, and he still was convicted.
Yeah. I know, and Rudolph was, like, shook by it, too, because he thought he did enough. He was for sure that he did enough, but nope, he did not. So Michael Peterson is a free man as it stands right now, and I was reading an article. Somebody did an interview with the director. He's a French director that heard about this case, came over, and, like, right away got so much access, which to me is what separates it from the other ones.
Right.
But I guess it was about 4 months in where, and you probably notice it while you're watching it, the prosecution decided to pull the plug on it. And so, because at first I'm like, oh my God, we're hearing from Harden, we're hearing from the assistant DA, we're like, we're right in their meetings. Like, what are they going to talk about? We're right there. And so after about 4 months, they're like, we don't want to do this anymore. So they pulled the plug on it. There was, then there was like a weird thing between the like lawyer-client privileges. And like, if there's a camera crew there, like, does that void it? And then the prosecution was asking the camera crew for their footage.
Exactly.
So they would, what they would do is, like, Rudolph had to say that the camera crew and the director were, like, employees of his. Or they were some sort of loophole. And then once they would get the footage, they would immediately send it to France. So, like, the prosecution even asked. They're like, let's see. Like, we're entitled to this. And they found the workarounds. And then also, I guess, early on, the family, Michael Peterson was less willing to have his family on camera. But then that obviously, later on, they were in it all the time. But
yeah,
at first,
they were like the main stars.
They were, yeah.
So with attorney-client privilege, it has to be between you and the attorney. It can be conversations with people the attorney employs. But if you have a third party in there, it destroys the privilege. So any conversations, that's why you don't see any in-depth conversations between Michael Peterson and his attorney about any sort of the like really nitty gritty details of the case.
Okay. I mean, you still see a good amount, but yeah. There's certain times where they're like, all right, let's cool it off.
Right.
Yeah. Sounds good. I mean, I don't know. The other thing that the director said too is like, he's done with it. Like he's like, this has been such a long process and it's been a big part of his life. And you just wondered if there's going to be any follow up, but I don't think there will unless Michael Peterson commits another crime. Or a first crime.
Or confesses, or
whatever else. The last thing. So that's let us know at Dork Podcast and dorkpodcast@gmail.com if you guys watched The Staircase, what you thought of The Staircase. If you have any other lingering questions or comments about it, let us know. Before we get out of here, Nicole, have you watched Evil Geniuses on Netflix yet?
I have not. That's next up on my true crime.
It's not as good. I don't think it's as good as The Staircase. It's only 4 episodes. And so you can get through it obviously a lot quicker. And to me, it feels more like it could have been a podcast. Like, you know, they don't have the courtroom scenes and things like that, but it's a wild story. Like, I think you'll be intrigued by it anyway.
I'm looking forward to it.
All right. Anything else you want to say, Nicole? Any special shout outs or anything?
No, I think that's it. Just, I mean, maybe watch The Forensic Files because it was funny.
Okay. Good call.
I think it's like a novel murder or the title is something ridiculous like that.
I'll have to check that out. The Michael Peterson Forensic Files. Very good. Yeah. All right, we'll be back next week. I think it's a Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, if I can get to see it. So we will talk to you guys next week.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of 4 amazing new iPhone 15s. And each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get 4 iPhone 15s on us and 4 lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.